This being the first episode of the Extreme Risk podcast, I was delighted to be able to get Mykhailo Ruskovsky to speak with me. He's based out of Kiev, and he is a master of risk. During our discussions, Mykhailo outlined the lead up to the war, the kind of things that people had to keep track of, where they got their intelligence from, what kind of risk assessment they had to undertake, what kind of preparation was needed, both from an organizational point of view, but also from a personal point of view, the people of Ukraine. How was this potential invasion going to impact them, and how could they prepare? He had some absolutely fantastic insights, and I'm really looking forward to also sharing the next few episodes, where we're going to have further discussions around the invasion itself, and then the months of war, how organizations had to adapt, and what the future looks like, both in terms of within Ukraine, but also the world, the ripple effect. So if you're interested and you enjoy this podcast episode, then look out for the next ones coming soon.
Mykhailo, welcome again. For those of you listening, I met Mykhailo in Bahrain quite a few years ago, before COVID, when we were still allowed to have physical trainings. And we got to talking, got to know each other. We did an episode of Risk Managers Getting Coffee. And we got on very well. And I'll hand it over to you, Mykhailo, just to introduce yourself a little bit about your background. There's obviously a lot of information about your background on the Risk Managers Getting Coffee. So anyone that's looking to see how you got into risk management and, you know, what brought you back to Ukraine, you know, via from Italy, via Czech Republic, they can see it there. But if you want to just give a brief introduction, please.
Yes, sure, Alexander. Hello once again. So just a few words about my background. So I started my professional career in insurance. It was Italy, then Czech Republic, back to Ukraine, where I basically made the next step in my career path towards the risk management. And the recent more than 8 years, I've been heading the risk management functions in different industries, starting from insurance with Allianz, then moving to the largest state-owned company of Ukraine, Naftogaz of Ukraine, that is covering the whole oil and gas process in the country, and then moving to a broader energy sector to DTEK, the largest privately owned energy holding. And basically, this is my career path throughout the recent more than 10 years. So I got some really good background in this regard.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember when we were first chatting, the amount of knowledge that you were gaining and experience, it was brilliant. But and where are you now? Because I know that when, you know, the invasion happened, when the war started, I was on the messages with you, talking to you, trying to find out if everything was okay. And you were in Kiev at the time. And then you said that you were now in between going back and forth. So where are you at the moment?
Well, I'm already back to Kiev, so the capital of Ukraine, and now here, continue working. And really, this was a very messy 3 months. I think we'll have a long discussion with interesting takeaways for both risk management and for business continuity management, and overall the review of our approaches towards risk management and insurance also as a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I think we thought it was a good idea to get together. I mean, from my perspective, managing risk management, I've managed risk management in Iraq, which was, you know, it was quite a situation, but it's nothing like what you've, you know, had to go through. So from my perspective, this is like, even for me, it's a massive learning experience listening to you. And I think a lot of people will get a lot of good information from this and get a feel and understanding of what, you know, what some of the aspects were. And this is going to be in several parts, this series, and we're going to talk about, you know, leading up to the war, the invasion itself, what happened during that period, and we're going to look forward as well. So really, I mean, I remember there was a lot of discussion in the newspapers amongst commentators about, you know, we're seeing military activity, we're seeing you know, stuff happening at the borders and what's going to happen. And I don't think there was many people that believed that, yes, he's going to invade, you know, this is going to happen. There was a lot of people that thought it's just posturing, and it's unlikely to lead to anything. This happens before and nothing happened. What was your views at the time? What were you thinking about and how are you preparing for that?
Well, before answering to a practical aspect of this question, I would start. I would take a step aside to risk management science and behavioral economics that is very applicable in our case, namely the prospects theory and the loss aversion. Basically, Ukraine and Europe got trapped into this loss aversion situation, meaning that the real or potential loss is perceived by individuals more severe than a possible gain. This is what the loss aversion theory says. And sometimes the psychological effects of experiencing of loss or a possibility of loss might even include risk-taking behavior that could make this loss even more severe. And if we take this theory and apply it, for example, to the period of November last year or December, when basically we already had different sources, official public sources, newspapers, journals, like German Bild, they in December, they put an article where they described the invasion scenario. And it was, I would say, 60-70% just as it happened in real life. They were even stating out the time frame of January or February. This is one point. Definitely the situation was escalating. On the other hand, there was a perception of cost of activity. I would say it like this. Let's take an example. You're a very good risk manager, monitoring all the situation, reading the newspapers, reading the analytics, talking to different colleagues. And in the end of November, you come to your board and say, okay, guys, we are very likely to have the situation getting much, much worse. What is our suggestion? First, we need, let's say, war insurance coverage. It was possible. We need to, if we're in Ukraine. If we are in Ukraine, we need the diversification of our energy supplies. It covers both Ukraine and the European Union. We need to check our counterparties and supply chains. Will be they able to operate? We need to put our, to back up our data, our all our IT that might suffer. Do we have our servers located into a single place, or it's diversified, or it's cloud? Is our counterparty, is our provider doing all of this business continuity management issues to maintain the operations? And if we look at these suggestions now, it's very, very rational. If you appearance in the situation of end of November or beginning of December, this is the end of the year. All these measures, they require cost immediately. Insurance, servers, backup data, etc., etc. In the end of the year, you may be lucky if there is a person in the executive board who is aware about risk management and business continuity management. If not, you are not likely to get the funds. And basically, this is a this is the perception of this significant cost of insurance and all these measures, and the idea of maybe it will go on well. And I think many businesses, they got into this trap, and vice versa. What I observed in Ukraine, the population appeared to be much more economically rational, and from the business business continuity management more rational than the companies. As when the war started, myself, my friends, my family, my acquaintances, my colleagues, they all had the business continuity plan of their own. They knew what to do exactly at each and every step. I'm not talking about the entire 100% population, but the majority was like this.
Yeah, they sort of had some understanding of, okay, if this does happen, what are we going to do? And is there a reason for that? What do you think is the reason that people were so prepared, as in individuals?
I think this is the experience. Unfortunately, it's not the first time we face similar situation. In the year 2014, a much less scale conflict was in the eastern Ukraine, and basically the Ukrainian population knows what to do, and this is the thing that surprised me, actually, because there was no panic. When the war started, there was no panic. I don't know how it works, but everybody knew what to do. I mean, people in Ukraine, they know the sequence of actions. They knew what to take. I know one of our friends, they had their own BCP, business continuity plan, and it took them 10 minutes at 5 a.m. to take all their stuff. Everything was prepared. So they just took 3-4 bags. They went downstairs, put it in the car, and left. 10 minutes.
That's amazing. This is, when we talk about, you know, risk management, we always say everyone's a risk manager. Everyone's responsible for risk. This is a perfect example when, you know, if you can be that prepared, then that's a, you know, that's a real positive. But you're saying, so the individuals were better prepared than many of the businesses. And so generally, how do you feel the businesses, you're saying that the individuals were more prepared than the businesses, but generally, what was the preparedness of businesses?
I would talk about the businesses I was working with. When at Allianz, we built up, I was responsible for business continuity management for in my last year at in the last years at Allianz, and basically we were building up a BCP based on our experience that we had in the years 2014 and 15. And one of the key lessons learned that is still important now is the simplicity and clearness of the BCP. And this is the trap that other companies may have fallen into. Because if you open the international standards, ISO or other manuals, they are really, really difficult. So, and when you apply these standards, it's good when there is specific level of maturity of the function. If you start building up from scratch, this does not work. At Allianz Ukraine, we made a very simple and comprehensive BCP. Meaning that, let's say, an employee, a regular employee of Allianz Ukraine, if he wakes up at 5 a.m. With the war started, he has one pager knowing what to do, where to go, whom to contact. Clear as that. Because when you're in a stressful situation, you will not read the manuals of 10 pages, of 20 pages, never. And this is a trap. So you need to make it comprehensive for a child of 12 years old. If it works for the, you can make this stress test with the child. If it works, if he or she understands clearly what to do, this is an effective BCP. If it's like a few books that are stored on the shelf, this does not work.
Of course, and if it's a few books, then it never gets updated either. So yeah, you make very good points. Yeah. Okay, well, so what in that situation, You know, you talked about, you know, oh, we need to look at insurance. We need to look at this. We need to look at that. How did you assess the potential that this was going to happen? What was your assessment process? What did you have to consider knowing that, okay, things are getting a bit, you know, serious now? Will there be an invasion? Won't there be an invasion? What were the assessments like? What kind of risk management were you doing at that time?
In the end of November last year, we received a request from top management of DTEC to perform the military invasion risk assessment for DTEC group.
So this actually came from the top. That's interesting. Just
from the top.
Sorry to interrupt, but it's just the fact that they knew who to ask, where to go, and there was clearly some sort of risk culture. You've obviously done something there that they're aware that, hey, risk management is something that we need. I see a lot of companies where during COVID, risk management weren't even consulted in the process of looking at what are we going to do to deal with this situation. But here you actually got a directive to actually perform this risk assessment. So just on that note, I think that's a really good indication that risk management was working prior to this situation.
Yeah, sure. I think we'll talk about in our next episodes of how to make this framework working. But indeed, this is right. And the top management clearly knew whom to address. They know, okay, Mikhail is responsible for risk. So this is the question we addressed to himself. And we started working. That was an outside-the-box task. We have never done it before. So we started with the assessment of the organization. What are the vulnerabilities? So what is the structure of our assets location? Because the main impact may be basically directed to our power plants, to our drilling wells, to the gas production facilities, to our renewables assets, etc., and the power grids. So we made the assessment of these assets in few different areas. So it was clear, understandable that the possible threat may come from the north and from the south. And we made a sort of, let's say, a heat map for our assets, where the red zone was the closer to the border, to the north and east. Then we got amber, then we got yellow, and we also had we have a power plant in the western Ukraine that basically appeared to be green. The next step, you need to understand the value and the cost of possible loss of assets and the loss of income. So definitely this assets generates income. So there is two directions of impact. First is the enterprise value. The second one is P&L. And it's clearly applicable to the new financial and business year, because we were in the end of November. So you make this assessment. Then you start looking at the open source, open data that you have, the analytics. So there was a lot of news of these military trainings of Russia and Belarus around the borders. You knew the movement of the military forces. You understood the possible scenarios, and there was analytics in the internet that you may apply. So you basically take the scenarios, make your own based on the different sources that you take, and build up this assessment, what if. So what if scenario one realizes, how it impacts our heat map in regards of asset, what will be the monetary impact, and how we can work with it. And then we go to the step of possible mitigation. And here, one of the most important role is the insurance coverage. In the end of the day, the damage to the do the assets may be covered with the political violence insurance. For renewables assets, we had this coverage previously purchased. Luckily, we bought it in May last year. It's already a year we purchased it. It was not that costly at all a year ago than compared now.
Yeah. Just on the insurance end. So you're basically looking for gaps in the insurance, right? You're saying, well, what do we have? What don't we have? What do we now need to go and get? And as you say, for the renewables, you already had that back in May. For other stuff, you then needed to go and place it. And what was the pricing at that point? I assume it went up at that point, and obviously now it's...
It was possible to insure our assets that were insurable, because the coal power generation, the insurance market didn't want to take this type of assets based on the green strategy, European Green Deal, and all these ESG initiatives in the Western Ukraine and in the UK. Western Europe and in the UK. But the other assets were insurable. Definitely in November, the prices were higher than in May, but it was still possible. It would take, by our assessment, 2 months to make the extra insurance for the political violence war coverage and the related business interruption. And here we come back to this loss aversion trap. So you need to pay a significant amount of money for war insurance in the end of financial year, in the end of business year, when the dividends are being calculated, when the bonuses, et cetera, et cetera. And this was one of the problems also. This is why it is important to have a very sound risk management now that can in every company. Unfortunately, this is not the last crisis in Ukraine, in Europe, in the region, and in the world. We still have a lot of things coming that we still don't know, and they are not like we used to have it once in 10, in 15 years. Now it's like one in 3 years, one in 5 years maximum.
Yeah, we're barely getting out of one crisis, and here comes another one.
Yeah. Just remember, COVID was in 2019-20. It took us less than 2 years to get another one, bigger one.
And then what's, you know, we've still got recessions potentially to face, and yeah. Absolutely. So this was the risk assessment process that you went through. Was there other aspects? Were you going to mention any other? You came to the insurance aspect, which was important.
In the end of the day, we came up with the assessment, with mitigation measures that were driving the risk from inherent to residual. So we also made the assessment of the residual risk as if we use insurance, as if we use the IT data transfer, the new servers, etc. So this gave us the comprehensive understanding what the company may face if the military invasion starts with different scenarios. And this is very important. I want to stress it out. The new risk management approach should be based mostly on the scenarios to make the company more resilient. Because we face a situation when the mathematical and statistical models of pricing, for example, for the commodity goods, does not work in these crisis situations. In COVID, the prices for energy sources and other resources dropped extremely low. And it took them less than a year to jump a few times. Again, the models didn't foresee, didn't show the possibility that the industry and the world economy will recover that fast. And now we have, again, backdrop. And we have the energy prices in Europe beating the records. So this is very important to make the company really resilient. Yeah. And I see that risk management is the key driver of this resilience.
And that's interesting because you mentioned now, first of all, risk was given this task. Secondly, you're saying risk management is the key driver. But who else did you involve in the whole process? Who was involved in doing these assessments, but also in terms of the mitigations? Who did you involve there?
Well, definitely the financial guys. In the end of the day, the ultimate goal of any company is earning profit. So we need to work closely with the financial function to understand the possible impact of any scenario first, and then to understand the cost of mitigation actions versus the impact, because sometimes mitigation actions are much costly than their effect. Second function, if there is in a company, is a strategic guys. The guys who are looking on the fundamental trends. So it is good to challenge them. But sometimes they're over-optimistic. And it's a threshold, especially in the emerging markets, when there is a clear demand from the top management, from the shareholder, that we need to grow, we need to earn more, we need to expand, etc., etc. And this is also the perception and the one of the factors that influence the strategy. Sometimes it may be very, very optimistic. And if you get in this loop of every single year you are over-optimistic, you do not spend enough time on the resilience side.
Yeah.
So resilience is expensive. Let's face it. But in the long run, this is the thing that make the company working and survive.
You make a good
in
point.
Our case,
yeah, you make a good point there about resilience is expensive. You know, for the last sort of good few years, we've been looking at how to become more efficient, leaner, and that doesn't help with resiliency. You know, when you've got two people instead of four people doing a job, you lose one, and suddenly you've lost that resiliency in the name of efficiency. And so it's trying to strike that balance where, okay, yes, it's going to be expensive, but we've now got resilience if the worst happens. So we need to understand that we can't be 100% efficient because that will lead to a lack of resilience. But we also can't move all the way to resilience because that will make us unprofitable. So getting that sort of middle ground is critical. And so you involved strategy, you involved finance, and then you've done the mitigation plans as well, where you obviously involved everyone there as well. And I guess what you're describing is almost what-if scenarios. It's a, what if this happens? What if that happens? How does that impact us? What can we do about it? And it wasn't so much about how likely is this to happen. It's a case of you're assuming these scenarios do happen. But I suppose then you need to monitor and make, you know, leading up to what did eventually happen, the invasion, leading up to that, I guess you were monitoring to see, is this now going to happen? Is this leading up to one of these scenarios? How did you monitor? What was your approach to monitoring the situation?
I will make few examples that are very important in this case. The indicators, the key risk indicators, and they are applicable for both a company and individual. And in this situation, before we start the monitoring, we need to clearly set up the following. These are the indicators. We all agree on these indicators. And if the situation gets to a specific level of the indicator, we take actions, full stop. And this is very important rule. It's very, very simple, but sometimes it's difficult to follow it because the situation escalates and you think, oh, maybe we can wait a bit more and it will get better. This is the usual situation.
Yeah.
It will not get better.
So you're saying that it's important that when we set these key risk indicators, that you get the agreement from everyone that, look, when we set these thresholds within the key risk indicator, it means we need to take action. We all have to agree that. Because as you say, otherwise it's like, oh, let's wait and see. wait and see, and then it gets too late. The reason for these indicators and setting levels is because we've already thought about this and we know that it's you know, it's critical now and we have to do something.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And this is very important and one of the most difficult things to do.
And I'll be honest.
Go back to this loss aversion. Yeah,
I'll be honest. It's something that actually I think organizations, risk management departments don't think enough about. We set key risk indicators. Those that do might set the key risk indicators, but we have now an early warning system, but we don't necessarily link the action to it. It's always, well, we'll report on it when it happens and then we'll see what we do, rather than agreeing the action. So that's a really key fundamental point you raised there.
Right. And this is important for the continuity, for business continuity. Everybody knows what to do. If they see the red light of the indicator, everybody throughout their organization know what to do. They take out this one pager. Okay, red indicators mean I get in my car and I drive 500 kilometers, meaning that my car is fueled. I have my laptop with me. I have all the charging stuff, etc., etc. Very simple, but very strong things that really help. And coming back to the question of resilience, I have a really good the cost of resilience. I have a really good example. At Allianz in the year 2016, we made few not cost-effective solutions. It was the year 2016. We made a remote server, absolutely identical. The main server was located in Kyiv, and the remote one was in Lviv. And we made, with the IT guys, we made this mirroring that took around 15 to 20 seconds with all the information to be backed up on these remote servers. And we made tests. On Saturday, we were coming to the office. We switched off the Kyiv server. Then we use our laptops to connect to these servers, and they were working. All the data was there. And also, we rented out a small office, also in the Western Ukraine. We put there 12 laptops just to store them. So the company was paying the rent for 6 years. It was not that costly, but still it was cash out. We made tests also on the weekend. A group of critical workers, they took cars, it was three cars, they went to this location, they opened the laptop, connected to Lviv servers, and restored all the operations. If you were in the year 2021, if you were focusing on the efficiency, cost efficiency, etc., you will ask, why do we need this? If you are today, you will never have this type of
question. No, exactly.
So they just take their laptops, they go there, they know that they need to just open the computers there, connect, and they continue their work, the critical guys. The other, they had this one pager, they know, okay, if I move to another city, I notify my supervisor. Once I have the safe situation, I connect back to work, and we continue working. And this is what it meant by resilience. And the scenario was, when we're talking about the scenario, that the Kyiv office is no more. So let's say this is a scenario. What we do if the office is no more?
And I like that because it's broad enough that it doesn't matter what the actual source of the event is. The fact is we don't have the office. Maybe it's burnt down. Maybe there's been flooding. Maybe there's been protests. Maybe something else has happened. And it covers everything. I use the same example about, you know, the volcano in Iceland with the smoke. You know, I don't need to know that. Just like I don't need to know that there's a strike at the airport or there's been a 9/11 event. The at the end of the day, it's what happens if we don't have flights. This was when I was in Iraq and we had to fly people in and out all the time. You know, we had so many staff that we relied on the flights going back and forth. So it's keeping that scenario broad enough that we're not focused in on one specific event so that when another event happens, oh, well, we don't have a specific plan for that specific event. And also, the more specific you get, the more plans you need. And then we start getting away from, oh, this is easy, to it gets too complex.
Very, right. Very. You're 100% right.
And so, yeah, you were saying about the key risk indicator. So what kind of indicators are we talking about?
Again, the indicators must also be clear and understandable. So if you have a very complicated financial models, this is a different story. It goes for the business as usual. When you have the indicators related to resilience, first, they must be pretty clear, understandable, and cannot be treated differently. So is the clear situation happens. Okay, the missile hits Kyiv. It's clear as that. You cannot treat it differently. The force advances through another region. They capture a certain city. They move the borderline. This is the indicator. The currency drops. You have no internet. The certain level of cash drops. These are the indicators that cannot be challenged. On one way, it was not that type of racket, missile hit. It was not that type, but it was 2 meters or 5 meters, etc. So, and when you see it, nobody has any questions. This is indicator. We need to do this, that, like this. And it also applied to individuals. We had it in my family. This type of business continuity plan and indicators, right. And we agreed before, also with my family. Say, if this happens, if a missile hit Kyiv, we take our belongings and we move to this location. If situation improves, if we roll back, okay, we can move back. And this, in the critical situation, I think this is the most important thing. You do not have time to think over, to overanalyze, to make all these meetings, consultations, etc.
Everyone knows their role.
Simple. Yeah. And this is important that everybody knows what to do.
Yeah.
Because when you try to call someone, to reach someone, it's a mess.
Of course. So that's interesting. So obviously, you know, from my perspective, I'm watching on the news what's happening, you know, in the lead up, you know, the few months beforehand. And obviously we don't really get a full picture of what's happening. So how are people and organizations monitoring the situation in terms of how close is this to happening? You know, you mentioned the key risk indicators, but a lot of them are, okay, linked to how we behave. This happens, we do this. But even just from a personal point of view, where were you getting your information from to know what is happening at the border? What is happening in different parts of Ukraine? Where are you getting the intelligence from?
Well, fortunately, now we have a really lot of sources of open data. You can read the official sources. You can read the investigations. You can read the channels, for example, Telegram channels or Signal channel or other messengers. You monitor the social media. And sometimes it's important to also read the interviews and official statements of other party. If you see the pattern in their speeches, you can easily track the next things to happen. And from the business perspective, it is also important to understand the nature of business. If you're a production facility, hardly you can move a plant to another location. But there are already examples of the plants in the eastern Ukraine being relocated to the western Ukraine. But this is a more extreme scenario, but it's now working. So you can transfer all your equipment. But you need to understand if you have, let's say, power plant, heat power plant, coal power plant, the only thing to mitigate the risk is just take all your stuff, all your personnel out of the station and to close it. But your operations are first related to the energy security. Second, you provide electricity and heat to the population in this specific region. And last is the work of of the staff. If you move out this personnel, they do not have place to work another place to work.
Yeah.
So you need to understand what can you do for this specific location. You need to build the shelters that can protect people. You need to make clear rules and regulations what to do if there is the air defense alarm. So you need to just drop all your belongings and go to the basement. So first you need to save people. Then you need to understand how you manage to continue the operations. And there are situations when you cannot stand anymore. You cannot proceed anymore with the production. So this is a decision, again, the indicator. Yes, we are done. This is the, we fix the loss. We take out people, we close the facility.
Yeah. Okay, Mikhailo, amazing. I do have another question before we wrap up, which is, we've talked about the things that you had to do, the things that you prepared for and you were considering. I'm assuming not everything went right. Things didn't go as you would like it to go. And obviously, you know, the invasion did happen. But in general, you know, aside from that, things didn't necessarily go to plan. And what were their main learnings that you have taken from that? What were the lessons learned? How did the plans work? And what could have been improved essentially in either the process before or during?
The first one is being over-optimistic. This is the psychological trap you get into. You should think optimistically. You should think how you will work on the different scenarios. But you must be prepared for the worst situation. And you need to do. You need to know what to do. The second one is getting overcomplicated. So we already discussed it. And if your BCP is too complicated with 10 pages, it will fail. And you also need to have the trainings for these plans. If you see the situation deteriorating, getting worse, you need to make training. You need people to move through all this process at least once to understand what are the gaps. And there are gaps, definitely. And you don't want to find these gaps in the critical situation.
No.
And the third, let's say, failure is the communication. When you appear in a situation of crisis, there is a tsunami of information coming from different sources. And this was, I also faced the situation in the first days of war. Literally, you can read news all day long, 24 hours, not even having a coffee break or a break for meal. It was like that. So you need to outline clearly what information is important for you that takes into account your safety, your actions, and, for example, your company. So you need to outline these channels. All other go to archive. This is just the use the information for yourself, and it, you're not able to process it. All this information.
And I think another thing is, I remember when I was in Iraq, there was an attack on a convoy, and just that one small situation, I say small compared to what, you know, you experience, but just that one small situation caused a whole influx of communication and trying to verify what was actually happening, because every communication was different. Everyone had a different version of what had happened. People had died. People hadn't died. There was a fire. There was a local village that were, you know, surrounding it. No, there wasn't. It was a one-off. Everyone had different stories. So trying to find out what the true story was extremely difficult once it had happened, because everyone was throwing in their communication and then adding their own, well, I heard this, into it. So I'm guessing you probably had exactly the same sort of thing, trying to sort of push to decide what is true and what is not, or what the facts are on the ground.
Yes, absolutely right. And the communication issue, it refers to both the external information you receive and your external company communication. So you need to have the strict rules who communicates with whom. So when you're a big organization, you cannot have the CEO talking to all the employees. You have deputy CEO, you have CFO, CRO, you have head of department, etc., etc. So you build up this pyramid of communication also. So the regular employees, they know, okay, I have my head of my unit, head of my department, who is responsible window for communication with the company. And this is important. All these information flows are strictly built up,
yeah,
and set up and tested.
Any other lessons learned? Anything that didn't go to plan?
I think these are roughly the main issues we faced. Luckily, our IT system was ready for it, so we didn't have the problems with the with operations. We just took our laptops, we connected to remote servers, and that's it. But this was a huge work done by the IT guys to make the hardware working, to make the cloud working, and to make all the infrastructure efficient. And yeah, luckily we had our mobile communication working. I also had the spare mobile. I purchased another mobile operator to have two channels of communication. Yeah. And I think this is important also to have this duplication. You cannot rely on a single channel of anything.
No.
So you must be diversified.
Yeah,
in any of the important issues.
Mikhailo, amazing talking to you as always. I could talk to you all day, but obviously we want to keep it as short as possible for the purposes of listeners and watchers. I'm really pleased that you're safe. I remember we talked before the invasion, and then when I heard on the news about the invasion, and I think I tried to get in touch with you. I couldn't get in touch with you for a few days. I guess it was some telecommunication situation. And then you sent me a message saying, no, it's all good. And we remained in contact during the period. And it's great that you're safe, your family's safe. So I look forward to the next chats going forward that we'll have on the other episodes of this.
Yeah, looking forward and hope some good news.